Good morning. On today's program, migrant mothers and their babies being detained in Tunisia. And the French government have demanded strict new measures on fast fashion company Shein. It comes a month after the company opened its first physical store in Paris. But first, almost 4 years on from the start of the Russian invasion, Ukraine is facing into a harsh winter, with much of its energy infrastructure destroyed. The constant interruptions to its power supply has forced the Ukrainian capital Kyiv to adapt, using technology and ingenuity to keep the lights on and the city moving. As Owen O'Sullivan now reports.
Ukraine is a country quick to use technology and ingenuity to progress. Kyiv holds the same tenacity. The city has remained determined and adaptive despite everything it has faced. This resilience is being put to the test as Ukraine nears its fourth year since the full-scale invasion, and the country may be facing its most difficult winter yet. Russia has increasingly focused its attacks on Ukraine's energy infrastructure, particularly around the capital. In early October, Russia targeted Ukrainian gas production facilities with devastating effect, destroying around 60% of the capacity in a wave of strikes. Other attacks hit thermal power plants across the country, causing power interruptions in several regions, including Kyiv, affecting not only electricity, but also the heating systems that keep homes warm. This continual bombardment has forced authorities to take drastic measures to share the remaining power, particularly in the capital, where both scheduled and often unexpected blackouts designed to ease pressure on the strained power grid leave rotating districts of the city without power for up to 7 hours a day. But when the electricity cuts come, the city is not plunged into darkness. The street lamps may be off, but the night is illuminated by the determined glow of shop fronts and scored by the hum of generators. Nearly every business transfers from the grid to its personal power source situated directly outside its premises. Everything from pharmacies to cocktail bars, restaurants to the ballet, all continues as normal, provided there are no air sirens. The purchase of a generator has become part and parcel of the decision-making process for businesses in Kyiv. I spoke to Alexei Aronchak, the owner of a Kyiv bookstore, who explained that he had invested in an inverter generator with a battery system, telling me, "It's more expensive than a normal generator, but it does not bother our neighbors with noise or exhaust fumes. The generators not only keep Kyiv's lights on and its rooms heated, they are essential to keep a city that is striving towards modernity functional." In a move that is often associated with Scandinavian countries, the Ukrainian capital is becoming increasingly cashless. Most restaurants no longer have a physical menu. Instead, customers scan a QR code to order and then scan again to pay. Technological infrastructure such as the Dia application is also affected. Dia, which can be found on most Ukrainians' phones, is an all-in-one governmental app where citizens can store digital IDs, passports, driver's license, official certifications, and even their university degrees, all legally recognized, a goal reached by few other countries. More localized apps, such as Kyiv Digital, allow residents to purchase tickets for events and public transport, receive real-time air raid alerts, and locate points of invincibility. These are designated locations across the city where people can warm up and charge their phones during blackouts or airstrikes. With this indomitable spirit still comes caution, as people are still acutely aware of their circumstances. Alex Barovsky, a Kyiv-based theatre director, explained to this reporter how no one dares to use the elevator, and those who do often are trapped inside. And even though people are prepared, power outages are frequent and can be unpredictable. Yet even with this ingenuity, the city's resilience is stretched thin. Ukraine has lost roughly 70% of its overall power generation capacity since 2022. Even more striking is the damage done to thermal power plants. About 90% of their capability has been destroyed. With gas, coal, thermal sources severely compromised, the country increasingly relies on its nuclear power stations. At certain times of the day, as much as 75% of all electricity flowing into the grid comes from nuclear energy. This dependence introduces a fragile vulnerability. While Russia has so far avoided directly striking nuclear reactors, likely wary of international fallout, its military has begun targeting the substations that connect those reactors to the national grid. In early November, facilities in the Khmelnytsky and Rivne regions were hit, temporarily disrupting power flows and raising alarms about how close the war was edging towards nuclear danger. Engineers can repair these damaged substations, but repeated strikes could sever transmission lines faster than they can be restored. Should that final source of stable electricity be compromised, Kyiv's carefully constructed systems of adaptation, its generators, apps, and heaters may no longer be enough. the city's winter resilience depends not only on ingenuity, but on the survival of an infrastructure that is becoming more fragile day by day. For World Report in Kyiv, I'm Ono Sullivan.
Tunisian authorities have recently detained several migrant women, many of whom are nursing mothers with babies, and 17 children. They have been arrested and held with little food and water, and have been threatened with voluntary repatriation or face expulsion into the Libyan desert. UNICEF has raised their case with the Tunisian authorities, as Alizia Volkman now reports.
A message on WhatsApp begins, "Hello, Ma, how are you? I'm having a little bit of stress." It's from a migrant called Peter, who I've interviewed previously. The stress is the arrest and disappearance of his wife and one-year-old baby daughter. 2 days later, another migrant sent me a video of a group of women and children crowded in one room. A woman's voice narrates, saying, "Look at how we're suffering," repeatedly pleading for help, stating that there are no nappies for the babies. Another woman appeared sick, coughing violently. All the children look up at the camera, unmistakably sad and depressed. The migrant woman who sent me the video explained that her friend and the others had been arrested when they were out begging to raise enough money for food and life's necessities. Following their arrest, they said that they were being detained in this one room with hardly any food, very little water, and that police had beaten nursing mothers and the children. She explained that the police had demanded that the women give up their personal details and documents to them, and that they should accept to go back to their countries with the International Organization for Migration in their voluntary repatriation program. But if they refused to comply, they would be forcibly expelled at the border of Libya to be left in the desert, where they would be at risk of being captured by Libyan militia and ransomed. The women refused to comply and have not given their details to the police. The migrant nurse also sent me the location of where the women are being held. I looked it up and realised that the place of detention was El Wadia. It's a name I know far too well, having previously reported about arbitrary detentions there. According to Tunisian civil society's reporting, El Wadia has no legal status and has a long history of being a place of arbitrary detention. El Wadia is also where Peter's wife is being held. Peter came to Tunisia after his father died. He dropped out of his university degree course in Sierra Leone to take care of his father in his final illness, and he had hoped to continue his studies in Europe and get a good job. But, he tells me, since he left, everything has changed. He said, "I lost so many friends crossing the desert." For a while, Peter lived in the Olive Grove camps north of Sfax, volunteering with the migrant medical team there. But when his wife fell pregnant, they came to Tunis to have their baby. "Everything changes when you have a baby. I feel more responsible and I want to do everything to make her happy," Peter said. Communication from the women has gone silent, but not before the case was reported to civil society. UNICEF has raised the alarm with Tunisia's Ministry for Women and Children, and several letters have been sent to various UN Human Rights Council special procedures, including the working groups on arbitrary detention and torture. The civil society representative I spoke to said that they've yet to receive responses either from the Tunisian state or from the United Nations. Peter tells me that he's repeatedly witnessed Tunisian security services using this type of threat or force for migrants to accept IOM repatriation. In previous reporting, I've interviewed many people who have been forcibly expelled. Many reported severe beatings and other forms of torture, and for women, it frequently means rape. A case outlining such allegations of crimes against humanity against the Tunisian security services and authorities was lodged at the International Criminal Court 2 years ago, but the ICC has yet to open an investigation. Peter told me that migrants are very aware of politics and the funding by the EU and states like Italy for so-called migration control. In April this year, the Italian government gave 20 million euros to Tunisia, Algeria and Libya to fund a so-called voluntary repatriation program. The program is in collaboration with the International Organization for Migration. In response to my questions about whether IOM was aware of the use of violent threats to coerce this group of women and children, IOM sent this response. IOM Tunisia has not been contacted by the authorities to provide any form of support at the El Wadia Centre and is not involved in any of these operations taking place there. IOM has consistently advocated for the release of migrants in order to enable provision of assistance outside of any detention facility. Peter said, "People leave their country because their life is at risk. What is the security that you are going to provide for me in order to return safely? For now, Peter's wife's case has been filed in Tunisia's administrative court, petitioning for both a stay of action on expulsion and for her release. The process can take 3 months, but at least now, for Peter, he knows where she is. But he says he feels sad and lost without them. For RTE, I'm Alicia Falkman in Tunis, Tunisia.
On Friday, the French government demanded that Shein, the online Chinese fast fashion company, introduce strict new measures to ensure that products sold on its website comply with the law. This has followed a controversy over the sale of childlike sex dolls and banned weapons on its platform. Last month, Shein opened its first physical store in Paris, in the iconic BHV department store. The event attracted considerable media attention, huge protests, as well as thousands of shoppers. On a recent visit, Rosalind D gauged French reaction, as she now reports.
It's 11:15 on a weekday morning, and I'm on an escalator heading to the top floor of the historic BHV department store in Paris. As I climb from the ground floor, up past the first, second, third, fourth and fifth, there's signage at each level advertising what awaits me when I step off on the sixth floor. That would be Shein, the online Chinese fast fashion giant, which opened its first ever bricks and mortar shop in the BHV at the beginning of November, attracting shoppers and protesters alike, and eliciting strong opposition from French politicians, trade union bosses, and from some well-known designers whose clothes are currently sold in the BHV store. Agnès Bay, for example, has said that she will not renew her contract with BHV when it expires in January. Shein's meteoric rise to prominence over the past few years has been dogged with controversy over both its factory workers' exploitative conditions and the quality, unsustainability and negative environmental impact of its cheap, fast fashion clothing. Amid allegations of forced labour in Shein's factories, findings from the BBC and from the Swiss advocacy group Public Eye have certainly confirmed paltry pay and excessive working hours, well in breach of the 44-hour working week dictated by Chinese labour laws. On the day the Paris store opened, riot police were deployed to the Rue de Rivoli location as the protesters came out in force. So too, though, did the shoppers, with some 50,000 visiting Shein in the first few days, according to a spokesperson for BHV. On the day I visit the store, the metal barriers erected by the Parisian police a few weeks earlier are still piled high up on the street outside. But there's not a protester in sight. Nor, it has to be said, are there many shoppers on this particular morning. Perhaps 50 or so, in just over the hour that I spend in the shop and in its adjoining cafe. Surprisingly, of the punters that are there, either browsing or buying in the immaculately laid out shop that extends to some 1,200 square metres in size, the vast majority are aged in their 50s or 60s. That's not the case at the weekends. That's what I'm told by the young 19-year-old Shein employee who is behind the desk in the changing rooms, a pleasant area with spacious, individual, curtained cubicles. It's still quiet during the week, she says, but really busy with young shoppers once Le Weekend arrives. For her, this job is simply her way into the retail business. But is she not bothered by the negative publicity, by the protests? No, she says. Look around. Where are they? No protesters. They have gone now. The Paris-based American fashion journalist Dana Thomas, author of Fashionopolis, points out that when it comes to regulation, the fashion industry is one of the least regulated in the world. Shein, she says, is the junk food of fashion. And yet here it is, plying its trade at the heart of a city that takes its couture very seriously. Sylvie Martin, however, a chic, fashion-conscious 50-something Parisian who is manager of a small hotel located close to Bastille, surprises me with her reaction to Shein's arrival. Does she deplore everything it stands for, I ask? She shrugs her slender, cashmere-clad shoulders. It is what it is, she says. But fashion has to be accessible to everyone. And the prices are the attraction. You cannot blame young people for wanting that. Meanwhile, back in the shop itself, and mindful of potential protesters, Entering Shein right now comes with a compulsory security dimension, with all bags opened and searched on entry. The clothes themselves are well displayed, with Shein's two pricier ranges, Anusta and MOTF, clearly marked with signage, while the shop floor is dotted with a number of attractive seating areas featuring brightly coloured armchairs. Staff are plentiful, and dressed in the all-black trousers and top, complete with orange ribboned lanyard, that is the uniform of all the Beiashve staff. As I wander around, picking up items, some of which I later can't find on sale online, I've paused for a moment to examine a faux suede belted jacket when a woman aged in her 60s stops beside me. So does she support the opening of Shein in Paris, I ask.
Oui, bien sûr, she quickly retorts, reaching for the price tag on the jacket and waving it in my direction. Les prix, she says, sont fantastiques. At €34.99 for the jacket in question, she's not wrong. Interestingly, though, many of the price tags on the clothes in the Paris store are more comparable to Zara or H&M prices than to those that you encounter on Shein's website.
Emmanuel Grégoire, socialist politician and a candidate for Paris mayor next year, is appalled by Shein's arrival in his city, describing it as a battle for the future that we want to pass on to our children. And so it is that in Paris and across the world, the storm raging against the Chinese giant shows no sign of abating. For when it comes to Shein's cheap fashion, the cost, its opponents continue to argue, is simply far too high. For World Report, this is Rosalind Yee in Paris.
That's it from World Report for today. The programme was edited by Margaret Curley. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/worldreport or find us on all podcast platforms. We're back again at the same time next week. Until then, from myself, Ethna Dodd, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.